The Economist magazine continues for March 21st through March 27th, 2026, on Leaders page 10, and this is the last article in the Leaders section. Natural gas, lingering fumes. Gas will not be killed off by renewables anytime soon. But there are ways to rely on it less. The world is facing its second gas shock in half a decade. After Russia cut flows to Europe in 2022, intending to undermine support for Ukraine, the continent turned to liquefied natural gas, LNG, shipped from America and the Middle East, sending prices soaring. Now, LNG supplies from the Gulf have been cut off too. Power prices have subsequently surged. Some experts argue that renewables offer a promising way to get off gas and thereby ensure energy security. See Europe section. They point to Spain, which has pursued huge investments in wind and solar. So far this year, gas has set power prices that are only 15% of the time, compared with 89% for Italy. Solar's share of power generation in Pakistan increased from 0.7% in 2019 to 10% in 2024. The country's import bill for LNG for the rest of this year is likely to be $6 billion less than it otherwise would have been, according to one analysis. Unfortunately, the world will remain haunted by the specter of natural gas shocks for decades to come. Even in a world dominated by clean energy, natural gas will continue to be a critical part of electricity generation. Solar and wind power, along with batteries, cannot offer complete energy security. Governments can, however, limit the damage that gas shortages can do. Analysts contend that it's possible to run a cost-efficient electricity grid where the vast majority of power comes from renewables in concert with batteries. But a grid that is split between 90% clean energy and 10% fossil fuels does not mean one in which those two sources consistently provide the mix of energy. Instead, it is one in which, for a tenth of the time, nearly all of the power is derived from fossil fuels. That is because renewables are at the mercy of Mother Nature. The sun does not always shine, nor does the wind always blow. Batteries are increasingly able to smooth out short-term fluctuations in supply and demand. A cloud passing over a solar array, for example, or the evening peak after the sun goes down, but they cannot keep the lights on for longer periods. Other options are not appealing. Not all countries have the appropriate geography for hydropower. And in any case, water is at the mercy of the weather too. Europe's crisis in 2022 was worsened by a drought. New nuclear power stations remain prohibitively expensive. Alternative forms of long-duration storage, such as iron-air batteries or hydrogen, are in their infancy. For the moment, analyst net zero projections include a role for natural gas far into the future. Importers of gas will therefore remain vulnerable to supply disruptions. Governments will have to ensure there is capacity to satisfy all demand, which includes import capacity for LNG storage facilities and pipelines, as well as power plants. If global gas demand falls, supply may be dominated by a few low-cost producers. The market could become thinner, subject to moments of acute shortage. Beyond seasonal storage, taxpayers may need to stump up for strategic reserves. Though gas cannot be entirely avoided, there are some things governments can do to rely on it less. Grids should become bigger and smarter. That means time-varying prices, which encourage consumers to shift demand to hours when power comes from virtually free sources of energy, such as the sun and wind. If prices rise when clean energy is scarce, that will incentivize investment in promising forms of energy storage. Interconnections between grids can reduce exposure to local weather. Local pricing can also help. At present, there is often little incentive for storage and energy-intensive industries to be situated in windier or sunnier parts of a country. As a consequence, grids become congested when it's sunniest or windiest, allowing prices to reflect local conditions should help alleviate these bottlenecks, meaning that turbines would not need to be turned off when it's windy. It helps, too, that the costs of relying on natural gas as a backup are far fewer than depending on it for everyday energy needs. Britain's Climate Change Committee, an advisory body, reckons that the additional investment cost of moving from gas to renewables would eventually be offset by substantial fuel savings. There is no getting off gas for a while, but its power to shock can be reduced. The Economist magazine continues on page 14, the by invitation section. And this week's the by invitation section is by Badr Al-Busadi. America's friends must help extract it from an unlawful war. Badr Al-Busadi is the foreign minister of Oman. He mediated the most recent nuclear talks between America and Iran. Twice in 9 months, the United States and Iran have been on the verge of a real deal on the most difficult issue that divides them, Iran's nuclear energy program, and American fears that it could be a weapons program. So it was a shock, but not a surprise, when on February 28th, just a few hours after the latest and most substantive talks, Israel and America again launched an unlawful military strike against the peace that had briefly appeared really possible. Iran's retaliation against what it claims are American targets on the territory of its neighbors was inevitable, if deeply regrettable, and completely unacceptable result. Faced with both Israel and America's described as a war designed to terminate the Islamic Republic, this was probably the only rational option available to the Iranian leadership. The effects of this retaliation are felt most acutely on the southern side of the Gulf, where Arab countries have placed their trust in American security cooperation, now experience that cooperation as an acute vulnerability, threatening their present security and future prosperity. For Gulf states, an economic model in which global sport, tourism, aviation, and technology were to play an important role is now endangered. Plans to become a global hub for data centers may need to be revised. The effects of Iran's retaliation are already being felt globally, as maritime traffic through the Straits of Hormuz is severely disrupted, driving up energy prices and threatening deep recession. If this had not been anticipated by the architects of this war, that was surely a grave miscalculation. The American administration's greatest miscalculation, of course, was allowing itself to be drawn into this war in the first place. This is not America's war, and there is no likely scenario in which both Israel and America will get what they want from it. Hopefully, America's commitment to regime change is just rhetorical, whereas Israel explicitly seeks to overthrow of the Islamic Republic and probably cares little about how the country is governed or by whom once this has been achieved. With this objective in mind, Israel's leadership seems to have persuaded America that Iran has been so weakened by sanctions, internal divisions, and the American-Israeli bombings of its nuclear sites last June, that an unconditional surrender would swiftly follow the initial assault and the assassination of the supreme leader. But it should now be clear that for Israel to achieve that stated objective will remain a long military campaign to which America would have to commit troops on the ground, opening a new front in the forever wars which President Donald Trump previously vowed to end. This is not what America's government wants, nor do its people, who certainly do not see this as their war. The question for Friends of America is simple. What can we do to extricate the superpower from this unwanted entanglement? First of all, America's friends have a responsibility to tell the truth. That begins with the fact that there are two parties to this war who have nothing to gain from it, and that's the national interests of both Iran and America lie in the earliest possible end to the hostilities. This is an uncomfortable truth to tell, because it involves indicating the extent to which America has lost control of its foreign policy. It must be told. The leadership of the United States will then need to decide where its national interests really lie and act accordingly. A sober assessment of those interests would indicate that they must include a definitive and decisive end to the nuclear weapons proliferation in the region, secure energy supply chains, and renewed investment opportunities in the context of the region's growing global economic significance. All of these would be best achieved with Iran at peace and with its neighbors. They can surely be identified as shared objectives for all the countries of the Gulf. How to get there from today's catastrophe is the challenge. It may be difficult for America to return to the bilateral negotiations for which it was twice diverted by the temptations of war. It will certainly be difficult for the Iranian leadership to return to dialogue with an administration that twice switched abruptly from talks to bombing and assassination. But the path away from war, hard though it may be for both parties to follow it, may have to lie through precisely this resumption. Envisaging positive energy. The parties need an incentive to summon the necessary courage to engage once again. This could be provided by linking the bilateral negotiations essential to resolving the core American-Iranian issue to wider regional process. Designed to achieve a framework for transparency on nuclear energy and the energy transition more broadly in the region. As all the countries of the region look towards their shared post-carbon future, secure innovation and the development may depend upon some basic agreement on the role nuclear energy will play. Could this offer a prize large enough for all the main players to willingly endure the difficulties of dialogue to win it together? It is certainly something Oman and its Gulf Cooperation Council neighbors can propose. Some initial talks could lead over time to confidence-building measures and a consensus around the role nuclear energy will play in the energy transition. The ultimate destination of such a process is, of course, impossible to determine, especially in the middle of a war. But might it be possible, perhaps in the context of a regional non-aggression treaty, to secure a substantive regional deal on nuclear transparency? The Economist magazine continued on page 15, which begins the briefing section. America's War on Iran, and this section covers from pages 15 through 18. Double deadlock, Riyadh. There is plenty of scope for the fighting to intensify, but no obvious way to end it. The conflict ravaging the Middle East may best be understood as two parallel wars. One is the campaign of American-Israeli airstrikes against the Iranian regime. The other is Iran's war on the global economy. Both are largely one-sided. Iran cannot repel the warplanes prowling its skies, and America has no easy way to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. The narrow waterway vital to the flow of oil, gas, and other commodities, or to stop Iranian attacks on energy production facilities. For Iran, that asymmetry is the point. The energy war is meant to induce America to halt its air war and deter it from someday launching another one. Yet, it may do the opposite. Donald Trump seems unlikely to end the fighting while the strait is blocked. Crucially, his allies in the Gulf agree, having borne the brunt of Iran's retaliation. Most now want to see the regime incapacitated. America, Israel, and the Gulf states started the war with different aims. Yet, as the fighting enters its fourth week, Iran is pushing them into alignment. The Pentagon says it has carried out more than 7,000 strikes across Iran so far. Israel has conducted thousands of its own, including a series of raids targeting senior Iranian officials. On March 17th, it assassinated Ali Larijani, a wily politician who was among the most powerful men in Iran. See later article. And the head of Bazigche, the regime's paramilitary enforcers. The next day, it announced that it killed the intelligence minister. Beyond such headline-grabbing attacks, America and Israel have also battered Iran's armed forces, from depots that housed missiles and drones to factories that produce them. More than 100 ships have been sunk. The death toll is mounting, with more than 3,000 Iranians killed, including at least 1,300 civilians, according to Hanrana, a human rights group. For some American officials, winning the air war is enough. They have tried to nudge Mr. Trump to declare victory, but the president seems increasingly focused on the other war. The prices of oil and natural gas, already high, leapt yet more as strikes on energy facilities intensified, and the cost of everything from fertilizer to helium, a vital input in semiconductor manufacturing, has soared too. See finance section. Straight shooting. The Gulf of Hormuz is not literally closed. Iran's surface fleet has never that formidable to begin with, and much of it is now at the bottom of the sea. Instead, the regime has imposed a de facto blockade through a mix of threats and sporadic missile and drone attacks on commercial vessels. Shipping firms, understandably, have little tolerance for that sort of risk. America will struggle to reassure them. The Pentagon has mulled naval escorts, but is not ready to provide them. Mr. Trump spent several days this week alternately begging and badgering allies in Europe and Asia to join a maritime coalition. Then, on March 17th, he said that was no longer needed. In fact, he wrote, "We do not need the help of anyone. In truth, it would be hard for any navy to secure the strait. Its geography is forbidding. It's just 54 kilometers, 34 miles wide, at its narrowest point, and flanked by mountains on both sides. Even beyond this choke point, the seas either side are within easy range of Iranian drones and missiles. Escort ships would have mere seconds to react to an attack. Sending troops to secure the coastline is a non-starter, given the size of the force required. Iran could just continue shooting from inland." Instead, Mr. Trump may shift his attention elsewhere. For decades, he has been fixated on Karj Island, a rocky speck where 90% of Iran's oil exports are loaded onto tankers. He told an interviewer in 1998 that, were he president, he would do a number on it. On March 13th, he got his chance. America bombed dozens of military targets, hitting storage depots for missiles and naval mines. Karj the Heveled. The oil terminal was left untouched for what Mr. Trump calls reasons of decency. That may be because he aims to seize it. A maritime expeditionary unit, which trains for this sort of mission, is being redeployed from Japan to the Middle East. See next story. America could no doubt capture the island. The idea would be to use it as a leverage. If Gulf states cannot export their oil, neither can Iran. If the regime proves stubborn, however, American Marines could have to withstand a potential barrage of missiles and drones. Oil prices would no doubt jump further, both from the loss of supply. Iran ships around 1 million barrels to China, and the prospect of a longer war. Meanwhile, Iran is pursuing its own sort of escalation. A share of Gulf oil is still flowing through two pipelines that bypass the Strait of Hormuz. One of them, in Saudi Arabia, can transport up to 7 million barrels, two-thirds of the kingdom's total output, to ports on the Red Sea. See map. The other, in the United Arab Emirates, UAE, can move about half of that country's 3.4 million barrels to the port of Fujairah. Dozens of tankers are already sailing towards Saudi Arabia's west coast to pick up crude. On recent nights, Iran has launched dozens of drones at Saudi oil fields, up from just a handful at the start of the war. In the UAE, it has attacked Fujairah, the source of the plume of smoke in the image on the previous page, a big gas field, and the Rawais refinery, which can process nearly 1 million barrels a day. After Israel bombed Iran's portion of the world's biggest gas field on March 18th. Iran targeted the processing plant on the Qatari side of the same field. All of this suggests a change in tactics in which Iran tries to hit the sources of energy supply, not just the vessels bringing it out of the Gulf. With so many tankers bound for the Red Sea, Iran might also encourage the Houthis, its militia ally in Yemen, to resume their own campaign against shipping. The group largely halted traffic through the Red Sea in 2024 by firing missiles at ships, which it described as a show of support for Palestinians in Gaza. Even a single attack now would probably be enough to send markets into a panic. Yemen watchers are split on whether the group would agree, though. Some think it would prefer to stay out of the war to avoid antagonizing the Saudis. The loss of oil and gas exports is not the only economic blow to the Gulf. This should be one of the busiest times of the year in the region, with a final spurt of business and tourism activity between the end of Ramadan on March 19th and the start of the scorching summer heat. Instead, conferences are being postponed until autumn, and hotel workers are being furloughed for want of guests. Thousands of expats have left, while many planes to the Gulf arrive almost daily, almost empty. The magnitude of Iran's attacks on Gulf states has decreased from around 1,000 missiles and drones on the first day of the war to about a tenth of that today. Even occasional attacks are disruptive, though. Emirates, the state-owned airline of Dubai, has been gradually resuming flights. On March 15th, it had hoped to operate around 60% of its pre-war schedule. Then debris from an intercepted Iranian drone hit a fuel depot at Dubai's main airport. Quiet diplomatic contacts with Iran have been infuriating. The regime sometimes denies that it's attacking civilian targets at all. "They're gaslighting us," says a diplomat briefed on a recent call. Iranian officials are also airing maximalist demands, such as the closure of all American military bases in the region. They also suggest they expect plentiful investment from Gulf states to repair the damage from the war, a request Gulf officials likened to a mob boss running a protection racket. The Gulf states have not joined the fight themselves, although on March 17th, Anwar Gagash, a diplomatic advisor to the UAE president, said his country might be willing to take part in a naval coalition to secure the strait. In any event, their capabilities would be limited. More important is what they have not done. Urge America to stop. The message to Mr. Trump from most Gulf leaders has been that the war cannot end with an emboldened Iranian regime able to hold their economies hostage. Many Israeli officials want to fight on as well, seeing this as a rare opportunity to wound their main state adversary. Mr. Trump's aims are still unclear. Does he want to topple the regime, make a deal with it, or merely hobble it? Officials in the Gulf struggle to parse his ever-changing pronouncements. Yet, by making this a war over energy, Iran may have made such questions moot. It is pushing all of its foes toward the same conclusion, that the war cannot end until the regime is crippled. The briefing section is continued on page 16. America's Armed Forces. Fire retardant spray. Washington, D.C. The Iran war could sap America's military power for years. "We live in a world of scarcity," declared J.D. Vance, then a senator, at the Munich Security Conference in 2024. "We don't make enough munitions to support a war in Eastern Europe, a war in the Middle East, and potentially a contingency in East Asia." Mr. Vance, who is now vice president, was correct. The war that his boss, Donald Trump, has launched in Iran will pile pressure on America's overstretched armed forces, leaving them less prepared for a conflict in Asia. The impact of Operation Epic Fury could last for years. America probably uses just over 5,000 munitions of different sorts in the first 4 days of the war and 11,000 or so in the first 16 days, according to an analysis by Jahara Matesik, Morgan Brazilian, and McDonald Amo of the Payne Institute of Public Policy in Colorado. That would make Epic Fury the most intensive opening air campaign in modern history, they note, eclipsing the first 3 days of NATO's bombing of Libya in 2011. Once American and Israeli aircraft gained control of Iran's skies by destroying the country's air defenses, they could fly close to their targets and use short-range bombs, which are cheap and plentiful. America is thought to have hundreds of thousands of JDAMs, a guidance kit that can be strapped to ordinary bombs. "We have a nearly unlimited stockpile," Pete Hegseth, the war secretary of war, recently boasted. 2 weeks into the conflict, the Pentagon estimated that 99% of the munitions it was using in Iran were of this sort. The problem lies mainly in what was consumed before then. In the first 6 days of the war, when American airplanes needed to keep their distance, CSIS, a think tank in Washington, estimates that over 1,000 scarce and expensive standoff munitions were fired. Hundreds more medium-range missiles, as well as anti-radiation missiles, which home in on air defense radars, are also thought to have been used. Stockpiles of these are far less plentiful, although the precise numbers are secret. An even bigger problem relates to air defense. Iran's initial salvos of ballistic missiles and drones have burned through a significant chunk of American and Allied interceptors. In the first week of the war, America is estimated to have fired around 140 Patriot PAC-3 MSE interceptors and more than 150 THAAD interceptors. Stocks were already low. America had reportedly fired a quarter of its THAAD inventory last year while defending Israel against Iranian strikes. "We have enough Patriots to keep going," notes Mark Kansian of CSIS. "But every one we fire is one fewer that we could use for Ukraine or in the Western Pacific." Replenishing all this will take years. The cost of replacing the first 4 days' worth of munitions would cost between $20 billion and $26 billion, estimates Messrs. Matisic, Bazilian, and Omoyer. The problem, however, is more to do with scarcity than cost. America is thought to have used more than 300 Tomahawk cruise missiles in the opening days of the war, but the Pentagon had planned to buy just 57 new ones in the current fiscal year. There have been no deliveries of the THAAD interceptors since 2023, and the Pentagon has not placed any new orders this year. A puny 39 interceptors are slated for delivery in 2027, 6 years after they were ordered. The Pentagon has grand plans to speed up procurement with big multi-year contracts. It wants to raise production of Tomahawks from 60 to 1,000 a year, and PAC-3 MSEs from 600 to 2,000, for example. But Congress has not agreed to pay for this, and the supply chain for munitions is opaque and gummed up. The motors missiles use are a good example. Some materials, such as propellant, are available from only one or two firms, often after a long wait. Other components involve critical minerals controlled by China. Congress can appropriate $26 billion overnight, notes Messrs. Matisic, Brazilian, and MOA. It cannot appropriate gallium, neodymium, or ammonium perchlorate into existence. Only a handful of drones, fueling tankers, and jet fighters have been lost in the war. Wear and tear is the more serious concern. This is most acute in the U.S. Navy. America has 11 big aircraft carriers, but only a handful are available at any one time. Two, the USS Abraham Lincoln and the USS Gerald R. Ford, are now involved in Epic Fury, with the USS George H.W. Bush thought to be en route. The Ford has been at sea for almost 270 days. In mid-April, it will break the record for the longest carrier deployment since the Vietnam War. In 2 months, if still deployed, it will break the record set by the USS Midway in 1973. Fighting decay. The strain is evident. The Ford suffered a 30-hour fire this month, leaving more than 600 sailors without beds. The New York Times reports, such mammoth deployments will be felt long after the war ends. It's like driving a car at 200 miles per hour for months without an oil change, says Joe Costa, a former Pentagon official, now at the Atlantic Council. That compounds a massive backlog in maintenance. The current price of operations is likely to produce occasional carrier gaps when America cannot deploy a carrier in some parts of the world for 2 or 3 years, says Stacy Pettijohn of CNAS. Personnel also are exhausted. Long deployments contribute to family stress, which is a risk factor for suicides, notes Mr. Costa. This does not mean the war is all bad for America's armed forces. Mike Horowitz, a former Pentagon official, points to 3 bright spots. One is the debut of new, cheaper weapons, such as the low-cost, uncrewed combat attack system, LUCAS, a drone modeled on Iran's own Shahids that could be mass-produced far more quickly than Tomahawks. The second is the combat experience gleaned by American forces, a huge differentiator between the United States and China. The third is America's use of modern AI-enabled decision support systems for tasks such as targeting and command and control for the first time on a large scale. But Mr. Horowitz is not sure that these benefits outweigh the longer-term costs. Indeed, the very process of testing new weapons and gaining experience under fire also carries a risk. We're revealing our tactics to China, said Mr. Costa, pointing to the question of how America might reopen the Strait of Hormuz. The Chinese will learn about how we demine, he says. If the Chinese have a sense of our tactics and the time it takes, they will use that information if they decide to invade Taiwan. Mr. Vance and others in Mr. Trump's orbit came to office arguing that America had wasted blood and treasure in the post-2001 wars in the Middle East, that the armed forces were woefully overextended, and that America ought to husband its resources in preparation for a future conflict with China. Instead, the war in Iran is cannibalizing forces in Asia. A Marine Expeditionary Unit has been diverted from Japan, and parts of the THAAD system from South Korea, while eroding the readiness of the units that might be needed there in years to come. There's no sugarcoating the situation, argues Tom Kuroko, also of CSIS. The scale of recent munitions expenditures and the degradation of U.S. missile defense capability may well undercut deterrence in the Pacific for the remainder of this decade. The last article in the briefing section comes from page 18. Who's in charge? Iran's government. Jerusalem. The assassination of senior officials weakens Iran, but also makes it less predictable. The ranks of Iran's leadership are thinning. On the first night of America's and Israel's airstrikes, several generals, the defense minister, and the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, were all killed. This week, Ali Larijani, the man who appeared to be running the country after the initial blitz, died in similar circumstances. So too did the two generals heading the Bazidjaj, a military force used to suppress internal dissent, and the intelligence minister. Given the disappearance of Mojtaba Khamenei, Iran's new supreme leader and the son of the previous one, who has not been seen in public since his appointment, and is rumored to have been badly injured, is no longer clear who is calling the shots or naming successors to fill all the gaps in the leadership. The relentless assassinations are likely to make the regime more brittle, but they may also make it harder to bring America and Israel's war on Iran to any sort of negotiated end. Israel depicts the killings of senior Iranian officials as paving the way for Islamic Republic's overthrow or collapse. We are undermining this regime in the hope of giving the Iranian people an opportunity to improve it, Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, said after Mr. Larijani's death was announced. Over 2 weeks into the war, Israel seems to have excellent intelligence on the whereabouts of Iranian officials. It is also bombing bases of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, the regime's most elite fighting force. It has even hit street checkpoints manned by the Baj. The assassinations appear to be designed to progressively disintegrate the state, as a former British intelligence officer puts it. However, Israeli intelligence assessments suggest the regime cannot be brought down by airstrikes alone, but only in conjunction with internal dissent. They also contend that protesters will not take to the streets as they did in huge numbers 2 months ago, while bombs are still falling. Much will hinge on who, if anyone, is in charge whenever the bombing abates. Mr. Larijani was unusual in that he straddled the three main pillars of the regime, the IRGC, Islamic clerics, and the bureaucracy. He was the son, brother, and son-in-law of senior Ayatollahs and trained in a seminary. He fought with the IRGC during the Iran-Iraq War. He also served as culture minister and speaker of parliament. He was hard to pin down ideologically. As head of state broadcasting, he hounded reformists. Yet he also aligned himself with Ali Akbar Rafsanjani, the pragmatic former president, who led post-war reconstruction in the 1990s and pursued détente with the West. As a philosophy professor, he taught the Enlightenment, specializing in the works of Immanuel Kant. Moreover, Mr. Larijani knew the levers of power. Abroad, he acted as an envoy for the supreme leader to China, the Gulf states, and Russia. When Oman sought to broker a last-minute deal on the eve of the war, it was Mr. Larijani, for example, who set Iran's negotiating parameters. Some saw him as the potential leader of a more pragmatic Second Islamic Republic, or even Iran's counterpart to Delcy Rodriguez, Venezuela's vice president, whom Mr. Trump elevated to head of state. They remove the one person most likely to reach an accommodation, says a veteran opposition leader. There is a chance that another pragmatist might emerge from the internal jockeying now underway. Figures such as Mohammed Bakir Qalibaf, a former IRG commander and parliamentary speaker, or Hassan Rouhani, the former president and architect of Iran's nuclear deal with America in 2015, could help make the regime more conciliatory. Neither is on America's list of officials to be hunted down. Ideologues on alert, but hardliners may spy an opportunity. They had previously vetoed Mr. Larijani's candidacy for president. They are thought to want to appoint Saeed Jalili, a more ideological figure, to replace him at the head of the National Security Council. That would signal an Iran less likely to agree to any deal to end the war and more likely to pursue nuclear weapons. They will substitute Arajani with a madman who prefers martyrdom and will go to the end, says an Iranian journalist recently arrived in Britain. The regime's tone, at least, is hardening. On March 18th, Abbas Araghchi, a foreign minister, not only demanded an end to the bombing of Iran, but also for America and Israel to cease all attacks in Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, and Yemen. Opponents of the regime may see an opening too. Growing numbers of the security force services are said to be reluctant to show up for work, for obvious reasons. Meanwhile, unrest simmers. Iranians have not rallied around the flag in the numbers they did after America and Israel's previous bombing campaign in June. Yet Iranians largely ignored the call of Raza Pahlavi, son of Iran's last monarch, who was overthrown by the Islamic Revolution to protest to mark Chahasanbi Suhari, an ancient Persian festival, on March 17th. The regime still appears to function. If it falls apart, the result may be chaos and bloodshed. A former member of the IRGC says that should the chain of command rupture, the security forces have a plan to disperse into 30,000 five-man units. The longer the conflict drags on, the more brittle Iran's political order becomes, and the greater risk that the state fractures into competing centers of power with unpredictable consequences. Letter section from page 11. Shop till you don't drop. You wrote about how AI tools are being prepared for the physical world. I can show you the world. February 28th. The article treats grocery shopping as an optimization problem awaiting automation. Retailers may tremble at the thought. Supermarkets are not just warehouses. They are carefully choreographed arenas of temptation. The smell of baking bread, the strategically placed confectionery, and serpentine layout are designed to maximize profits. Business schools teach sensory marketing, shelf placement, and psychological merchandising precisely because humans are gloriously irrational. A perfectly rational humanoid, dispatched with a shopping list, would stride past promotional displays, ignore aisle seductions, and return with exactly what was requested. Basket sizes would shrink along with margins. World models may help robots navigate aisles. Whether they can keep those aisles profitable is another matter. Nimit Suri, Pune, India. How to tax the rich. Your article correctly argues that higher income taxes are a poor instrument for extracting revenue from the ultra-wealthy, whose fortunes derive largely from appreciating assets rather than wages. The Robin Hood State, February 21st. We should indeed be skeptical about New York City's proposed levy and California's wealth tax. Yet, after acknowledging the outrageous loophole that allows the ultra-rich to avoid capital gains if assets are held until death, even as they borrow against the assets to fund spending, you dismiss reform because fixing this would raise only about 0.1% of the GDP a year. This conflates two separate questions. whether such reform would solve budget pressures and whether the current arrangement is defensible. A tax system that permits the wealthiest Americans to accumulate and transmit dynastic wealth, largely untaxed, sits uneasily with your claim that redistribution has kept pace with inequality. Moreover, by pointing to increased income taxes on the rich as evidence for this redistribution, you make the same error that New York and California have made, that taxing the incomes of the rich is relevant to the wealth gap. The problem is not that politicians want to tax the rich, but they're reaching for the wrong tools. Closing gaps to address the structural asymmetries of the taxation of capital versus labor would strengthen the coherence, perceived legitimacy, and fairness of our tax system. Philip Doherty, West Palm Beach, Florida. Coincidence. Bagehot, February 28th, identified the paranoid style in British politics. The concept was introduced by Richard Hofstadter's lecture, The Paranoid Style in American Politics, at Oxford University on November 21st, 1963, the day before President Kennedy's assassination in Dallas. Alex Wade, Loughborough, Leicestershire. Ebbs and flows. The profile of China's tech elite mentioned Xi Jinping described them as a Nongchaoer, those who ride the tide of great economic changes, among the lucky few, February 28th. That revives 1,000-year-old term that seemed charmingly outdated today, although it is a fitting label for those plunging into the sea, Xiaohui, in the 1980s. The new generation would much rather be dubbed China's Elon Musks than tide players. Innovation today is less about riding the waves and more about redefining the current. Jin Liyun, Shenzhen, China.